your advice. Scotch and soda, what's yours?
I've got gin and tonic here.
Oh, here you go.
Yeah, man, this is so great to have you on. Welcome to Music on the Rocks. I am really excited to have my next guest. He's an amazing player. He's played with the Chicago Symphony, Detroit Symphony, and of course, a lot of people know him from San Francisco Symphony and his tenure there. He is a founding member of the Summit Brass, and he has got a brand new book out called Through the Door, A Horn Player's Journey. And I'm really excited about this book. So it's available on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. And I'm really excited to talk to him. So here we are, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's been really, I retired in 1998 after 40 years of doing this. And so I can't believe it's been almost 22 years now that I sort of quit playing actively. I played for a little bit afterwards, after I retired, maybe 4 or 5 years, but I just wasn't willing to put in the time every day to stay at the level because there was no reason. So I very happily decided I'd just talk about it and not play anymore. And every time I pick it up and try to play, it's not very good.
Well, I can imagine that once you retire and you kind of hang the horn up a little bit, that when you do decide to pick it up, it's got to be frustrating because you know what you can sound like and what you're supposed to sound like.
Right. You become addicted to a certain level, and when it's not there, either you put in the time or you hang it up.
I feel like similar, just getting older and all the athletic stuff I used to do. Now, when I jump down something that's half my size, I'm like, wow, that is not how that's supposed to feel.
You have a ways to go yet, Chris. Wait till you're 84.
Yeah. I really hope I make it to 84. So all right. When did you start playing and why did you start playing the horn?
Well, that's all in the book. The reason I started is because as a little kid, I lived in an old two-story house, and there was a great big bathtub, and in the bathtub was a rubber hose that was used for a shower, kind of. And as a little kid, I remember disconnecting that hose and playing it. And I realized I could get a couple of partials. I mean, I could make a couple of notes. Then I became fascinated with that whole thing. And so from there, it was to the trumpet or the cornet. And then eventually, when I entered high school from the eighth grade, I fell in love with the horn because I went to a concert and heard my old teacher, Jim Winter, play. And that sold me. That's who I wanted to be. So
wow. So you kind of discovered the horn on your own. Usually somebody has to show you, hey, if you blow through this, you can make a sound. You just discovered that by accident.
Yeah, or the band director says, look, we got too many trumpets. You better play this. We need a couple of these people.
Right.
It was fun playing the trumpet, but it wasn't my instrument, and it wasn't my sound. My sound on the trumpet was really quite dark. So I was more adapted to the horn.
When did you start getting serious about the horn?
You want the real truthful answer?
Yes.
Well, I just went on sort of natural ability. Now, I'm dyslexic, and so school was a sort of a problem. I couldn't memorize the multiplication tables and certain things like that, but I did have an aptitude for music. And so I just went on my ability. I always felt music, and I had music in the church where I grew up, and my mother was a organist, pianist, and I was very involved with music. I realized I just went on natural talent. I had a wonderful career in the college. You know, I was sort of the top guy. As a freshman, I joined the Fresno Philharmonic, which was newly formed as the third horn. My teacher was the first. And so I had a wonderful background, and I remember playing the Britten Serenade as a junior in college, and I didn't know it was hard. In fact, I played it twice on the same program because one of the singers got sick. I was just sort of buzzing along, and I never liked to practice. And I really didn't want to figure out what I was doing. I just went on natural ability. And I got to Chicago and I started taking lessons with Farkas. And we just hit it off really well. I could already play and he was impressed with my playing. What he didn't know about my playing, it was hot and cold. I would do too much and the next day I was really stiff and I couldn't play. And I had no ability to stay at the same level. I was up and down. But somehow I impressed him at the lessons and he treated me more like a colleague than a student as a senior in college at Northwestern. And so we hit it off and one thing led to another. And he told me at Christmas, he said, "Are you going home to California for Christmas?" I said, "No, I have to stay. Money's a big problem. I have to stay working in a bookstore." And he says, "Well, will you be available for an audition?" And I said, "Well, what's it for?" And he says, "Well, I can't tell you." Well, it turns out that Reiner, who was, at those days, there was no committee and no formal process for auditioning. The conductor just picked somebody. The conductor, Reiner, wasn't happy with one of the players in the section. I won't mention who it was. And he didn't trust him anymore. And he evidently told Farkas that he was going to New York to hire a horn player to be Farkas's assistant. Now, Philip was, how should I say it? He needed a lot of support. He was an ultimate perfectionist. And he had had an experience evidently before that Reiner had brought a horn player in from New York who thought he was really slumming to go to Chicago. So he didn't give Philip any help at all. I mean, he sort of looked down his nose. "You're not from New York, you know." Huh. And Philip was deathly afraid that Reiner would go pick somebody that would make his life more difficult as principal horn in Chicago. Right. So Philip went in and said, "Look, I've got this student at Northwestern. Evidently, this is what I put together. I've got this student at Northwestern, and I'd really like to have him for my assistant." So Reiner said, "Fine, bring him in. This is when you could still do that." And Farkas, being the ultimate politician, said, no, you've got to hear him. You've got to have an audition." So an audition was arranged for the Chicago Symphony, unbeknownst to me. And I got a call. I was still working in the bookstore around Christmas time. And they said, "You're scheduled for an audition with Fritz Reiner." And the whole in Chicago, this whole mystique around Fritz Reiner and what a tyrant he was and how he could fire anybody without notice right on stage during a rehearsal and even during concert. He'd just have you play. And if it didn't work out for him, he'd send you off stage. You were done. So I had heard enough concerts in Chicago to know the standard of playing there. And I couldn't believe the level of playing, the level of that orchestra. And so when I got a call to go play this audition, I was really petrified. I mean, I'm not ready to do this. I'm not ready. But I went anyway. And the story is, it's in the book, is I walked in and I sat down and I said, "What would you like to hear, Dr. Reiner?" And he said to me in his normal voice, "Play Heldenleben." So I picked up my horn and it was cold. It had been cold. It was December, middle of December. And I tried to play that first note, the low B flat, and it didn't speak at all. It was just air. So psychologically, I figured, well, my audition's over. I missed that first note. It's done. So I just totally relaxed. I said, "I don't know what he's going to do now. He's probably going to send me home." What he did was he went over to his credenza there and he picked up this book, which was a brand new, right hot off the press publication of Farkas's book, The Art of Horn Playing, which was autographed by Philip to my dear conductor, Dr. Ryan, whatever it was autographed. Philip being the politician that he was, you know, Philip had, he had a studio and it was just, the walls were covered with pictures of conductors congratulating him on his playing because he would go right to the conductor and, you know, he did all that. Anyway, it's never been my thing, but so he went over to the counter and picked up this book and he began thumbing through it. And finally he looked up and he looked at me and he says, your teacher says you must loosen the arm brochure for the low notes. I call that a fagotto. That's a firm grasp of the obvious. So what I just needed was a second chance. You know how if a low note doesn't speak like that, right, you just rearrange. And so I did that, and I played the low note, and then I played the excerpt. But the amazing thing was I didn't care anymore because I had already failed the audition. And this was the basis of my whole horn philosophy over the years of playing, which became the idea of creative not caring. You have to not care in order to be free from the devils that attack you on what you just did and what you're going to do, but being in the present. I was sitting there playing this audition. It wasn't perfect, but it was fine. And I could play musically, and there were no nerves anymore. I didn't care.
Right.
And thank you very much. I left. And a couple of days later, I got a call. You have to come down. You're in the Chicago Symphony now. We need an extra horn for the Stokowski concert. Oh, my God. You know, this is a whole lead up to your question was, when did you first get serious? That was the moment when I realized what I'd gotten myself into, and that I was in no way in a place where I could be in the Chicago Symphony. I could play. What I didn't have was this steadiness. I had ups and downs. Yeah. Some days I was stiff and it didn't work. Other days I could play all over the place. So I actually got serious. That's when I went down into the basement and I decided to figure out exactly what I was doing. And I asked Farkas, I said, you know, I don't have any consistency in the high register. And my slurs, I have trouble slurs. He says, don't worry, kid. You sound great. Just keep doing what you're doing. And so I ignored that advice and really decided to get serious.
Yeah. Well, I think you're the first horn player in history who got serious about playing the horn after they won the job in the Chicago Symphony.
Well, Chris, things were much different back then.
Yeah.
The whole level of performance now for young players is, you know, you have an audition for a position, probably any one of the first 20 people on there could be successful at the job. Everybody's overqualified. Everybody in an orchestra these days is overqualified in that the level is so high that there's a great risk of boredom, that what they have to do is beneath them in a way. I think of that as string players who are sitting there on a stand next to each other. One's in heaven and the other's in hell. One's totally loving playing this music and the other one is just saying, I should be a soloist. I should be in a string quartet. I hate this thing.
Right. I think that a lot of people get into something and then they realize it's not all they wished it was or had it built up in their head to be.
Well, that's true. But if you're in an orchestra like Chicago or even San Francisco at the end where the level is so high,
right,
that it's always a challenge. And the intensity of the music making is so high that you're totally involved. There's no place for your mind to drift off and daydream. You're just there in the present and in the now, you know. And that's the key, really, to being happy in what you do, is that if you can be totally in the moment of that performance and you're not thinking about what you're going to do after the concert or what's coming up in 20 majors or what you just did, but you're right there at the moment. And that's something I think that fortunately I had for most of my career, where I really wasn't bored. I was just, I think if I had more technique and ability, I might've been bored, but I had just the right amount to where most things were a challenge.
Well, you were in the Chicago Symphony for 4 years, I believe.
5 years.
5 years. Okay. So you were in the Chicago Symphony for 5 years and then you moved on to Detroit, right?
Right.
So how long were you in San Francisco Symphony? Because that's where I came to know
25 years.
You're playing. 25 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
25 years. Yeah. I had a gift in Chicago because Actually, I was 2 years as assistant to Farkas, and then I was 2 years assistant to somebody else who I won't name. And then the fifth year, I was co-principal along with Frank Brauch. And the manager came to us and said, you're going to remain co-principals in the Chicago Symphony. What I didn't know and what I found out through the back door at Northwestern is that that manager was totally lying to me and that they had hired somebody else, Clarendon Van Norman from the Met, to come in. He only was there a couple years. This was before Dale. And I realized after playing a whole year of co-principal in Chicago that I didn't want to go back to assistant. I really didn't want to. I wanted to see if I could actually do this job. And, you know, serendipity, the doors just opened. That's the name of the book, of having these wonderful opportunities. It just so happened that Pittsburgh and Detroit, First Horns, were open. And those two conductors happened to be in Chicago at that time. And so I went up to the hotel room and played for each one of those people, and I got both jobs. And I had to decide which one to take. I realized that Steinberg had a different First Horn player in the Pittsburgh Symphony every couple of years for quite a while. And I still really wasn't secure about being a principal horn player. And I figured that my chances of survival, because I really wanted to see if I could do it, were better in Detroit. So I chose Detroit, and I had a wonderful 9 years in Detroit where I really learned the repertoire and learned how to do what I needed to do.
Right.
But then when the San Francisco Symphony had an opening, my wife and I, of course, we both grew up here. We were high school sweethearts, and my wife's father's a farmer, and we had a farm here. And for us to get back to California was just incredible. And so I figured my chances of getting that job in San Francisco were pretty good, since I'd had all this experience and sort of a reputation. But I hadn't auditioned. I hadn't auditioned in 9 years. So I figured I better practice. So it so happens that the Boston Symphony was looking for a first horn too. So I went there not as a person who wanted that job, but as a practice, because I hadn't really experienced the committee kind of audition that was beginning to happen. All the auditions that I ever played were just for a conductor and maybe a personnel manager. And I didn't know how this new thing was going to work. So I went to Boston, I auditioned, and it turns out Chuck Cavalosky and I tied for that job. Mm. And they couldn't decide who to hire, so they were going to have us come back and play. Meantime, I went to San Francisco after having this practice audition in Chicago, pretty much tied again in San Francisco. And I had this deja vu when I was on the plane from flying from Detroit to San Francisco that I was going to be able to come back to California. It was so great. And I'd have this wonderful job in San Francisco, which would be ideal. Anyway, we had the audition, and it was a committee, and they added up the points, and Chuck had a few more points than I did. So they brought him in. We were all backstage waiting to see the results. The manager came out, and I thought he'd ask me to come in and sign a contract. Well, he took Chuck, and he went into the room, and pretty soon, after about 5 minutes, Chuck came stomping out of there. He walked by me and he said, why don't you just stay out of my life? And I said, well, I'm busy with my own life. Anyway, so they said, won't you come into the room with us? So I went in there, and they had this clause in the contract that you had to either accept or deny this contract at the moment. They didn't want any negotiation. You had to say yes or no right there. And Chuck said, no, he couldn't possibly take the job because he was a finalist in the Boston Symphony. That's where he wanted to go. That isn't where I wanted to go. So they offered me the job. I said, where do I sign? I'd sign it. Anyway, so Chuck got what he wanted, and I got what. And it worked out great. And Chuck and I have been friends over the years, and we sort of laugh about that. But
that's an amazing story.
Yeah.
So one of the first times that I ever heard you, and I was aware that I was listening to you, I mean, because I'm sure I had heard you many times in recordings with the orchestras, but I was in high school and I just wasn't that aware yet. But the first time I knew that I was listening to David Krable was when I bought the Orchestral Excerpts for Horn album. And I got that when I was in high school, and it was a big deal. because this is pre people, you couldn't just go onto YouTube and get this free information from everybody. You had to either hear the excerpts from recordings with orchestras or in your lessons, you're learning them. But this was one of the first times that I had come across an album where it was like somebody who was an established, like world-class player playing these excerpts for you, explaining them. And it was invaluable. How did that come about?
Well, that was one of the most fun things that ever happened to me. I was involved with Summit Brass. Gail Williams and I were in Summit Brass together, along with a couple other people. And the head of Summit Brass at that time, David Hickman, called us both into his office and he said, we're thinking about doing this series, Orchestra Pro, and we're going to start with the horn. And we wondered if you wanted to do it. And I said, oh, yes, I'd love to do it. I'd love to do it. And they asked Gail, and she said, well, she sort of deferred to me. She said, Dave, you've been playing for a whole lot of years in these. Why don't you just do it? I'll bow out. We could do it together, but I think you should do it. Bless her heart. So I did it. And I distinctly remember thinking, oh, this is going to be a lark. I'll just go down and play those excerpts recorded in L.A., and then I'll talk about them. Well, it turns out I could play the excerpts just fine, but generating a scenario about each excerpt took a lot of time, and I had to write the stuff out, and I had to figure out exactly what I wanted to say about each excerpt and give a mood and a feeling about it and a reason to play it that way. So that was a wonderful experience, and you know, it's so obsolete now. Anybody can plug in their computer and get any excerpt played by a million different people. And good ones too. But it was a milestone in a way. And I started the whole process of a trumpet one and a trombone one, and then all the woodwinds. And then they did string orchestra pros too, playing the excerpts. Uh-huh. So I was the first one, and I sort of set the tone, I think, of the whole series in that I really talked about the emotion of each one of those pieces.
Yeah, that's in particular one of the big reasons I loved that CD, was that you were putting the excerpt into a picture scenario in your head. And it really puts you in a good place, especially when you're a younger player and you're just, a lot of times younger players, they are learning excerpts out of context. And yeah. They don't really realize what's going on in the orchestra, what's going on in other parts, and how you're even supposed to play the excerpt. And so to have a tool like that come along in a time, in an era when it wasn't readily available everywhere, was really an asset for so many players. I wonder how many horn players coming up in the 90s and the early 2000s like modeled their auditions after your playing.
Well, you know, Chris, it's funny. Even now, I run across people that I haven't met who had heard my record way back 20, 30 years ago or so on. I guess almost 30 now. And they hear my voice. And they've listened to this record so many times that it's kind of like, oh, my God, that's you. The actual quality sound of my voice is a shock to them because they've had it in their ear for a long time, and to actually hear it in person, right, that tone quality or whatever that is.
One more question about that album. When you were recording these excerpts, did it go through your head that this would be something that was going to affect a lot of horn players? So I better get my interpretation right. Or like, did you have any back and forths about the way you wanted to play certain things?
No, I've been playing those things and I've been thinking about those things for years before that. And that was already said. I didn't have to struggle to think how I felt about those pieces because I'd been playing them for years. Right. And so it was just a matter of sitting down and playing them and then figuring out how to describe what I did and how I felt about them. That was the hard part.
Right. When did you begin teaching? Like, what was one of your first teaching jobs?
Well, I taught a little bit at DePaul when I was in Chicago. But when I went to Detroit, I started teaching at DePaul. And I had some really wonderful students, but I wasn't really that involved in teaching. What I was involved in brass choir music and conducting the brass choir. And that was the great joy for me is conducting the brass choir and having a bigger influence over a bigger group of people. My conducting career is interesting because, you know, as an orchestra player, to go over to the dark side and become a conductor, you know, everybody hates the boss, no matter how good they are. You're not happy about who's up there telling you what to do. And I never was either, but I had some wonderful brass choirs all my life. And then when I got to Summit Brass, it was like in heaven. I was in this group of really, really great players. But I wasn't really happy with the conductor. And then one thing led to another. Over the years, I eventually ended up being the conductor of Summit Brass. And that was an incredible experience in that when you go from being a colleague in a group to being their conductor, a boss, there's a hell of a lot of resistance. Yeah. They don't. I was just sitting next to you. Now you're standing up there telling me how to do something. Forget it, you know. So there was a lot of resistance. And I really experienced that the very first time. We were doing a horn workshop up in New England. And it was the workshop was to honor James Chambers. And that was the first time I had sort of created this version of the Messiah for horn choir and soloists. And I was conducting it there with a choir of 150 or whatever, and soloists in the front. And I've been in these workshops over the years, and usually it's pretty atrocious in that, you know, everybody wants to be heard and louder than their neighbor. And right. It's really hard to wrestle them down into making some music. But I did. I got really tough, and I said, look, we're going to do it this way. And it was fantastic. I thought it was incredible. When those 150 voices of the horn choir did the choir part, you'd swear they were singing. You'd swear you could hear the words. The music fit the words so much. Anyway, and I had these wonderful soloists in front, and I thought it was an incredible experience. Anyway, I was so happy that this happened. And there was a reception afterwards, and I thought, well, people are going to be coming up and say, oh, that was really great what you did, you know. And I was like persona non grata. It was like people were ignoring me. And I realized for the first time, this was what it's like to be a conductor. You go over to the dark side and you make these demands and you want it your way. And people will do it, but they resist. And I was mystified, and I said, maybe it wasn't as good as I thought it was. You know, I had self-doubts, because I thought it really worked great. And James Chambers came up to me, and he said, that was the most incredible music I've ever heard from a horn choir, you know. And so I was, oh, thank God, you know. But conducting a horn choir or a brass choir has always been great. I ended up conducting Summit Brass, which was just really fun. There, you did feel a resistance from your colleagues, you know?
Yeah. Well, especially when you've got a group full of hotshots like that. I mean, everybody.
Oh, really? Yeah. One story from that, we'd have these summer camps at Summit Ski Resort, and that's why we call it Summit Brass. But the guys from New York would drive out, Alan Dean and Ray Mace and Joe Alessi, would drive out for this camp in the summer. And the story goes, and I'm sure it's true, that the three of them or whoever was in the car stopped at one of these lookout places that looked over a big canyon and whatever, you know. And they were looking over the edge of this canyon and viewing the scenery. A bunch of tourists were around. They're all looking. And Joe Alessi couldn't stand it. He goes in the car and he gets out his trombone. And he plays something beautiful out over the canyon, and it resonates, and it's just gorgeous. And the guys tell me there was a tourist that was close by, and he goes over to Joe, and he says, that sounded great. You should be in the New York Philharmonic. And Joe says, I am.
I have a similar story. A buddy of mine, I used to play with in Vegas. He was a trumpet player named Tom Snelson. He told me that once he was doing a job, and afterwards he decided to go down to the bar, and he sits at the bar and orders a drink. He's talking to the bartender, and a guy with a French horn case walks up and sits next to him on the bar, And he goes, and Tom looks at him, and he had already had a couple drinks, and he was a really funny guy. He looks at the horn player, and he goes, "Hey, you got a French horn case there. What are you, Vince DeRosa?" And the guy turns to him and he goes, "Yeah, I am Vince DeRosa." It was Vince DeRosa. He was there playing a different job. But all right. I want to get down to brass tacks here. I want to know about this new book.
I was looking at all these notes I have around in my office and stuff about playing and notes that I made so I could survive. You know, I always felt that I should be my own teacher. So I kept notes and I tried to figure out if something was going wrong, I could fix it myself. I didn't have to go ask somebody to do it. And so every morning when I played, it was like the warm-up was not really a warm-up. It was just a checkout to see if everything was working all right. I didn't feel like I had to play 30 minutes of long tones or anything. I just play some music. And if I was totally comfortable and free to play without struggling in any way, then I'd play. And I was fine. I've never been a big fan of practicing. I just do what I had to do. But somebody wants to, you only have a certain number of notes in your life. And if you use them all up playing long tones, you're not going to last very long. Anyway, yeah, so I had these notes and I thought, well, okay, I'd written some articles before for the horn call. And I've always had this kind of unique idea that playing is a balance of three factors, you know, the motivation, the vibration, and the resonance. If one of those three things is wrong or not working properly, then the other two have to work harder to compensate. Anyway, I had all these theories and I started writing and I realized it's really dry. And, you know, I read these articles about doing this and that, and I get bored pretty quick. Not because they're not good articles, it's because I don't want somebody else telling me how to do it or what to do. I want to figure it out for myself.
Right.
So I realized that what I had to say wasn't about the mechanics. It was about learning how to deal with my ego in performance. In other words, playing something and making a mistake and how embarrassing that would be. Your ego is fractured.
Right.
Or the idea that when you're playing something that you're worried about what you just did or you're worried about what you have to do, and not being emotionally and intellectually present at that moment that you're playing. And I realized that's what I had to say, not mechanical things. There are some mechanical things in the book, and they're in the appendix in the back. But the whole book is really, the essence of it is called Creative Not Caring. And it's figuring out a way to make yourself vulnerable when you play by taking chances. You know, years ago, well, when I was in Detroit Symphony, it must have been about 65 or 4 or something like that. After Detroit Symphony concert, some woman came up to me and she was just bubbly and she said, "Oh, you're a wonderful horn player. You never miss any notes." And that hit me like a ton of bricks. I realized that she didn't hear the music I was making. She didn't hear the emotion I was sending out there. What she heard was the fact that I didn't miss any notes. And I vowed at that moment to take chances in my playing to try and project how I felt about the music through the horn. And strangely enough, that made things a lot easier. It was a huge wake-up call for me that I couldn't play it safe anymore. I had to take chances. And strangely enough, this made things a lot easier with that attitude. If that makes any sense to you.
It makes all the sense in the world. I mean, when you're a young horn player and you feel like you're out to prove something, but nobody expects anything great out of you yet, it's easy to go out and be real cavalier with things. And then once you gain a little bit of notoriety and you've won some things and people start, in your mind, looking up to you, now your mind is telling you, I have to play at a certain level. I have to be perfect. I have to this and that. And then the cautious part of your brain tells you to stop taking chances and start being perfect. But that's where the excitement in the music ends.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's what the book's about, it really, basically.
I can't wait to get my hands on this book. Are there stories in this book? I mean, do you go into personal life stories or anything like that?
Well, I already told you that one about the audition in Boston and in San Francisco. Yeah, there's many pranks. And, you know, my life has been a series of having fun doing what I'm doing. Basically, that's it. And there's nothing gives me more joy than pulling off some sort of caper in the middle of some sort of serious environment, like a symphony orchestra, like a symphony rehearsal. I think my most famous caper was one time at a rehearsal, I stood up and I started shouting at the first trombone player. I said, "Trombones are too damn loud and it's been going on forever and I can't stand it anymore. I've got to say something. And all you do is play loud and, you know, on and on." And so it was my friend Mark, and he said, "Dave, let's go backstage. Let's talk this through. We can, you know, no, I've got to do something." I grabbed his trombone and I threw it on the stage floor and jumped up and down on it and stomped out of the rehearsal. Well, there were a few people who knew me well enough to know that it wasn't for real. But I was pretty nervous about doing this in the middle of rehearsal. So my voice was a little shaky, you know. I sounded very emotional, which I was, you know. Well, the orchestra was deathly silent, you know. Krebel's really lost it. He's gone over the edge now. He's gone, you know. I think I fooled most of the people. Oh. And the viola section was cheering because they always think the trombone's too loud, you know.
They're going to throw you a parade after that one.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a great story, man.
Well, there's another favorite story about involving Mark, who's really my best friend. I had an agreement with him that he's sitting right behind, 6 feet in back of my bell. And I figured, you know, when the time comes that I'm not cutting it anymore, I made him swear that he'd come and tap me in the shoulder and say, "Okay, Dave, it's time to retire." Fortunately, he never had to do that. And I got to 62 and I said, okay, not that I didn't love the job. The job of playing principal horn just got easier and easier and easier from when I started because of how I was approaching it and what I was doing. And so for the last 10, 15 years, it was a total joy. I could hardly wait to get down to the Mahler 5. That's no problem. We could do that, you know. I didn't think twice about it. The only thing that was my nemesis over all those years was the idea that if I had to start a note all by myself and there's no time, for example, Bruckner 4, yeah. You can make the string players wait for a bar or two, but eventually you're going to have to come in. Or the first note of the fifth movement of Mahler 5, when you play that A, bum, bim, bum, bum, you know, all by yourself. Anyway, I always had a problem with that. Starting the first note of the horn call in Britten's Serenade was always a problem. And it wasn't until about a year or two ago, a friend of mine, Miles Anderson, who was a former first trombone player, told me that the solution to that problem. And I'd thought of every possible way to fix that problem. But that problem was lodged in my mind somehow that I couldn't really deal with it. And believe it or not, and I know you can cut this out if you want from the interview, Miles says, all you got to do is think of your rectal area before you play. Put your attention down there. And it works. It works. You can start a note. You don't get all locked up and, you know, anxious. I used to sweat bullets on Bruckner 4 in that you set the whole atmosphere, the whole mood of that symphony. And if you just play da, 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 you know, it's nothing. But if you can play make a horn call from the forest somewhere, you know, people go, oh, yeah, I'm ready to hear this piece, you know. Anyway, oh, so I was going to tell you about my friend Mark. Mark helped me with some of these practical jokes, and we had a lot of them. But one of the best ones that was ever pulled on me was that we had a horn audition, and we listened to a whole bunch of players, 30 players that day, maybe, and 30 the next day. And that's really hard to do that because these people come out and their whole life is there. You know, they've worked all their life for this moment and they want this job. And you can just feel the angst that they're going through. And it's not my favorite thing. You end up listening in a negative way. You're eliminating people. You're not really listening for the music. If somebody comes along and really plays music, and I would say it's like going to a clarinet audition, and that's the craziest thing. Clarinets, they all sound the same. You know, they all play dee da da dee da 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 da. You know, clarinet, Mozart right. clarinet. One guy comes in and he goes dee on dun dee da 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 dee on dee on da. You know, he does this. He said, "Oh my God, this guy's a genius on the clarinet. He's playing music, you know." Anyway, so you're listening for that. You're listening for that spark of somebody who's not reciting his lines like in a play by rote, but he's understanding the character and he's coming across with some emotion in a way that touches your heart. So you're listening, and it's hard to listen that way. And you end up just crossing people off because it's boring. Anyway, I came home after this audition and the phone rings. This guy says, "I'd like to have some comments from my audition." And I said, "Well, I'd be glad to give them to you. What was your number?" I had my notes right there. He says, "Well, I was number 8 or something like that." So I went and got my notes and I came back and I looked at my notes. I said, "Oh my God." And I said to this guy, I sort of talked to him a while. I said, "Well, where are you from?" And he says, "Well, I'm from St. Louis." "Oh, really? Did you study with Roland Pandolfi there?" "Oh, yeah, right. I studied with Pandolfi and played extra in the St. Louis Symphony and so on, you know." Okay. So I went and got my notes. I came back and I looked at my notes. I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "You know, I have to be honest with you." I said, "I looked at my notes here. And when you played with the piano, you played very sharp. You were extremely sharp the whole time you played with the piano. And you never came down to that pitch. You never understood that you were playing sharp." The guy says, "I never play sharp." I said, "Well, you know, I'm just trying to be helpful. You asked me for my comments. And I'm just telling you that, you know, this is a real problem. This is why you didn't pass on to the finals." The guy says, "Well, your ears are really screwed because I never play sharp." So I tried to give the guy therapy. He says, "Look, you know, I'm just trying to help you. You've got to realize that the reason you didn't pass on is because you just played very sharp the whole time." The guy says, "Well, you're really screwed because your ears, you know," and he just got very abusive. And the more abusive this guy got, the more I tried to give him therapy. He says, "I'm just trying to be helpful here," you know, on and on and on. Finally, after quite a while, I realized something's wrong here. And I heard something in the voice that sounded familiar. It turns out it was my friend Mark. He had stuffed, at the last minute, he sort of got this idea, and he had stuffed some Kleenex in his mouth or something to disguise his voice. And I didn't really hear the sound of his voice. I just heard this guy who had all the right answers. He was from St. Louis, and he did this and that, and, you know, he had all the right credentials. And Mark was trying to get me to hang up on him. And I was trying to give him therapy. And this went on for quite a while. And finally, when I realized what it was, and he realized I knew who it was, we couldn't quit laughing for about 5 minutes. It was great. Just great. I've had some practical jokes pulled on me, but that I think was the best one.
That's really good. I love the fact that you're trying to, like, help the guy out. He's getting, the more vicious he gets with you, the more kindness.
Yeah.
So with this book, did you feel like you were trying to tell kind of a story of your life in horn playing?
It's the story of me getting healthy as a player. It's the story of me starting with nerves. I remember when I was principal horn in the Fresno Philharmonic. My teacher had gone away for a year to finish his doctor's degree, and I was a sophomore in college playing principal horn in this new orchestra. And Pavan came up. So I'm playing Pavan, and I was really nervous about it. I played it, but at the end, I was so nervous I passed out. And the second horn player was holding my shoulder so I didn't fall off the chair. And I remember times in Chicago driving to a concert and hoping I'd be in an auto accident so I wouldn't have to go on stage because it was too threatening. So the book is about really basically getting to the place where I could do this job and really enjoy it and have fun doing it and be conscious of doing it and not let these voices in my head take over and tell me it's scary, you can't do it, it's hard, et cetera, et cetera. I've seen other players who go the other direction. They start out and they're wonderful and they let these things happen to them where self-doubt comes in and they don't believe in themselves anymore. And my whole thing was to go the other direction.
I got to tell you, this sounds like it's a must have for every horn player, because I don't care who you are, you're having those thoughts. And those thoughts, they want to come into your head. They want to sabotage, you know?
Yes.
It's like all the work that you've put in, all the effort, all the time. And then at the last minute, your brain, for some reason, just has this little thing in you that just goes, you're going to screw it up. And this is yeah. And it's like, it can sabotage months or years of work. And to have a resource like this book from somebody like you, who's had such a prolific career and who's lived it and proved it, I don't think anybody should miss this.
One of the great philosophers of all time, Krishnamurti, was asked by his students, what's the secret of life, of everything? And he said, I don't mind what happens. And if you can play in a way that you don't mind what happens, it disconnects that thing that says, oh, I'm going to screw up, you know, or that voice that takes you away from doing actually what you're doing right then. It takes you away from being involved at that space and time with the emotion and the playing of that music.
I think it's really powerful what you said earlier. When you said that there were times you were driving to a concert and you just were kind of hoping you'd get in a wreck just so you didn't have to like go up against what you were about to go up against. I think that resonates with a lot of people. I mean, I know I've had those moments where it was just like, oh man, maybe there will be a snowstorm tonight and I yeah. some sort of freak accident, so I don't have to do this, you know?
How sick is that? I mean, when we think about it, how sick is that?
It is sick. I don't know. I just think that this is going to be a really cool book. I think it's going to be a really huge resource to people. And I'm really glad that you spent this time with me to tell stories and let us know about this new resource that's out for horn players, which is the book Through the Door, A Horn Player's Journey by David Krehbiel, one of the wonderful horn players of our instrument's history. And also, I got to say, everybody should still own that album, Orchestra for Horn. Something about the way that you talked through them and the way that you play the excerpts, it was really magical. And I think that it's another investment that people should make.
Well, good. Chris, thank you. It's been a wonderful, a whole hour with you? Yeah, a whole hour. And I hope you have success with this podcast and success with your life and your career. You know, people always said to me, oh, you play the French horn. It's a very difficult instrument. And you have to always say, no, it's not a difficult instrument. It's not at all. We play just one note at a time. We don't have to have 10 fingers out there on a keyboard and read a whole score. We just do our thing, and it's like the human voice. It's a wonderful thing. You can never think negative about it. You always have to think positive. And, you know, I always say, well, a friend of mine, Wes Jacobs, who was a tuba player in Detroit, said to me once after he retired, he said, you know, Dave, he says, in my whole career, I only missed 7 notes. And I said, oh, my God. Wes, that's just incredible. How did you do that? He says, well, I missed a few A's and a few B's and a few C's and a few D's.
Well, thanks so much, man. I don't want to take
Chris.
Your time, but thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Catch you later.